Hello, podcasting time again. Second podcast on the overlap between financial regulation and substantive law and how the two can work with one another. JP Morgan Chase and Springwell is an interesting case from 2008. Here we've got individuals acting on behalf of a family investment company. They accepted investment advice from Chase, which is a large financial institution. Some passing reference is made by Mr. Justice Gloucester to the applicable conduct of business regulation in her judgment, but only in passing. She found that the individuals who made the decisions for the family company had sufficient commercial knowledge and acumen to appreciate the risks of the investment which were being proposed to the family company, even though they had no financial qualifications, nor had they any employment experience themselves in financial markets. Instead, their high-risk approach to investment in foreign exchange markets particularly contributed to a sense amongst the bankers at Chase that they should be treated as being sufficiently knowledgeable, and this was found by Mr. Justice Gloucester to rebut any suggestion that they had been influenced into a course of dealing against their will, or that they had been coerced into investment product contrary to Chase's obligations to treat them suitably. It was held, therefore, that no duty of care was owed by Chase to this client company when all the investments went south because of losses suffered on the Russian bond market after the Russian banking moratorium. It seems to me, I would suggest, that it's an odd finding. It was based in part on a finding by Mrs. Justice Gloucester in the High Court after listening to 12 days of evidence that the individuals would not have acted any differently even if they had had the extensive documentation for the transaction explained to them. Instead, documentation was supplied, but no one really sat them down and held their hands and explained the risks to them. The difficulty I have with that is, how do we know how they would have reacted unless they had the documentation explained to them? Now, her finding seems to be that they would have barreled on anyway, and they would have entered into these investments anyway, because that's the kind of guys they are. And, you know, to be fair to her ladyship, she did listen to 12 days of evidence, and I didn't. But it's difficult to know whether or not they would have come to different results, whether they would have reached different conclusions on these investments or not entering into these investments, if they'd had all of the risks explained to them. You know, would that actually have made them realise that there was something about the deals which was unattractive to them? So if you want to borrow common law concepts of the need to act with informed consent from bits of contract law, particularly areas like undue influence, I'm thinking of Royal Bank of Scotland and Ettridge and all those cases on undue influence in mortgages. If there's no informed consent, then should we really be able to say, well, there's no duty of care here or no breach of contract here? I find that all quite difficult, I must say. There are other cases like Morgan Stanley and Puglisi Consentino. Here, the claimant bank, Morgan Stanley, sold a complex derivative product, known as a pearl, I don't think much turns on that, to the defendant, Mr. Puglisi. The bank was held to have been in breach of the regulatory standards that were imposed on them at the time, the conduct of business regulation then in force. The documentation, which was faxed to this private individual, identified him as being, quote, an expert customer, in spite of the fact that he was just a private individual acting in his personal capacity. Now, this is even though Morgan Stanley hadn't dealt with him before, and despite the fact that he hadn't dealt in any of these particular products, complex derivatives and repo products, that were being recommended by Morgan Stanley before. So Morgan Stanley sought to enforce this pearl against the defendant when it generated large losses for him. It was held that the defendant shouldn't be required to pay under the transactions because he wouldn't have entered into those transactions if he'd received proper advice from Morgan Stanley. There wasn't on the facts any evidence of undue pressure being put on him, Rather, it was simply a situation in which he hadn't been given appropriate risk warnings. So I think the Puglisi case stands in interesting juxtaposition with what's going on in Springwell. I just think it's interesting for us to try and think, well, where does the common law begin? How should the common law act? My own personal view is the conduct of business regulation gives us a very important yardstick, benchmark, as to what financial institutions should do in particular circumstances and how they should treat particular types of customer. And the problem, as already discussed in the lecture podcast and the summary podcasts to some of the seminars, is knowing then what conduct of business regulation actually requires. What does best interest actually require? How should client classification be conducted? But it seems to be at the client classification level at least there are clear obligations on a financial institution, and that arguably best execution and best interests impose fiduciary obligations over and above that, which would seem to capture the earning of undisclosed commissions and all those other sorts of things. So I think there's a lot in conduct of business regulation which should inform quite directly what goes on at common law as well. So there's a lot there. There are lots of interesting old cases as well relating to undue influence in financial markets. Barclays Bank and O'Brien is a good example, Royal Bank of Scotland and Ettridge No. 2 is another, both of those House of Lords cases. It's a fun old case of Lloyds Bank and Bundy, a decision of Lord Denning from 1975 that I discuss in the book in detail, where an old man was unduly influenced into entering into products by the bank manager turning up at his house with documents that he just simply didn't understand and encouraging him to sign them. So I'd encourage you to have a look at Herbert Bundy as well. Old Herbert Bundy, as he's referred to by Lord Denning, paragraph 2575 and onwards in the textbook. The general principle, as far as Lord Denning is concerned, is as follows. The fundamental rule is that if the parties have made an agreement, the court will enforce it, unless it is manifestly unfair and unjust. But if it be manifestly unfair and unjust, the court will disregard it and decide what is fair and just. So I think there's an overlap there, personally, between the requirements of treating customers fairly in the Conduct of Business Sourcebook, remember, and Lord Denning's explanation of the principle in Lloyds Bank and Bundy as to at what stage there will be undue influence which is sufficient to have a financial transaction set aside. Now, old Herbert Bundy is an old man. He's a private individual, and so we might think in those cases that the financial institution is more likely to have its agreement set aside if there is something that is manifestly unjust and unfair about the transaction. Whereas commercial dealings, certainly with other banks, it's far less likely that we will find manifest injustice and unfairness, I would suggest, because it's more likely a private individual sitting in their own home, an elderly man, having the bank manager turn up at the door of an evening and suggest to him that he should enter into this particular product and sign these particular documents. That's more likely to sound like undue influence. I mean, that's an odd thing. Nowadays, you wouldn't expect the bank manager to turn up in the evening and tell you what you ought to do. Interesting middle cases, though, with corporate customers, why not, but not financial institutions. You know, at what level with a corporate customer or someone in the course of their business, at what level do we start saying, well, that person is sufficiently expert to know, understand all the risks for themselves? Or at what level do we say, contrary-wise, the bank ought to be explaining all the risks, there should be some onus put on them? And I think that's what MiFID is doing. I think it is tipping the balance in that direction and saying, you have to ensure that this is fair in your dealing with your customer. You have to act in their best interests. You have to ensure best execution. I think, you know, in investment services under MiFID, certainly, that's the way in which we're going about these things. So I do think that's a changed world, and I think that ought to have an effect that leads through into the common law cases. There's a concept of the house bank, which I think is useful to spend just a second on. Because with these kind of corporate customers, What a financial institution wants more than anything else, really, is to be the house bank for that particular corporate client. You want to be providing all of their banking services, from the credit cards the directors use to buy lunch, right the way through to the corporate loans and bonds and everything else. You want to be doing all of that in a perfect world. You want to be first port of call. You want to be the key advisor. Yet, ironically, in legal terms, the more you are the key advisor, the more likely it is, I would suggest, that you are likely to be held to be imposing undue influence on a client if what you're also doing is earning unnecessary commissions and fees from that business, or if what you're doing is exposing them to losses like Bankers Trust in Bankers Trust and Damala because you are making that client buy things that possibly are unsuitable for them, more expensive than they need, so on and so forth. So there's a whole range of very interesting ideas there, I think, about how financial institutions and finance law should understand the liabilities that banks face, and how should financial regulation and its norms interact with the common law and equity. And so in the next podcast I'll think a little bit more about how equity maybe overlaps with some of these ideas as well. But it seems to me this is an essay writing theme, and it's also a commentary theme, and an issue which can come into problems, lots of different types of problems, raise exactly this. And this almost is the heart of a lot of our law of finance course on the LLB, is thinking, okay, we know this contract law, this tort law, this equity and so forth. How does financial regulation and how does the context of finance law make those norms operate differently? That's really what we're thinking about. How do those financial regulatory norms impact on the substantive law and possibly make it operate in one way rather than another? Good-o, and through the course I would suggest you should be trying to look for examples and tease out examples of exactly that sort of thing. 12 minutes is perfectly long enough. I will leave you to the rest of your life.